This is John Abrams, and this is The Variety Artist, episode 45. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. They're offering you, The Variety Artist, a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at thevarietyartist.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book right after this podcast and get your free audiobook. Now, let's start the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He cracks a bullwhip, walks on glass, juggles, lays on a bed of nails, and much more, all while singing right in tune. He's Regis Philbin's favorite act from AGT, hilarious and amazing, and a one-man sideshow. Variety artist, I give you David Darwin.
Thank you very much, John.
How's it going, David?
It's going good. How are you?
Good, good, good. We're going to talk about lots of stuff in this interview, but before we even start, you were performing under a different name before, is that right?
I was, yeah. So I performed under my given name for the first, let me think about this, I guess 11 years of my career.
Oh.
David Smith, and there are, as you may imagine, a lot of David Smiths in the world.
In fact, I was thinking about this, and I went to school with the David Smith.
Yeah,
and the guy down the street at Postal Annex, his name is David Smith.
Yeah, I've had banks like give me the wrong card and everything. Like it's been bad.
Well, that could be good. That could be bad.
I wound up with more money in that account and had a moment of like, is there any way? No, there's no good way this can end. So I'm going to go in and tell them. Yeah.
So what made you change it to Darwin?
So when I got engaged, my wife confessed to me that she had always looked forward to changing her name when she got married because she felt that her last name was too common.
Mm-hmm.
Her last name was Katz.
So she married a guy named David Smith.
So she married David Smith. Yeah, right. And I said, you know, I had always considered the possibility of taking my wife's last name when I got married because I always felt that my last name was too common. What we decided on was that we would find a third option, you know, a different option that we both liked and that we would both switch to that.
Oh, so does she go by Darwin also now?
She does, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I legally changed my name shortly before the marriage so that when we got married, she could easily legally assume my new name.
Gotcha.
Which incidentally is a huge pain in the butt process. When you're a man, like changing your name means like going through a whole bunch of agencies and convincing all of them, like, no, I'm not running from the law. I swear. I'm not running from alimony. I'm not running from, you know.
My friend, I won't even say his real name, but he changed his name to Buster Balloon.
Mm-hmm.
He actually changed his name from a regular old name to Buster Balloon. So now it's on his passport and everything. And he gets questioned when he goes to another country.
I'm sure.
Yeah, they look at his passport and they say, Buster Balloon, really?
I remember when I was a teenager, like I got into this period of where I started listening to Bob Dylan music and my dad, like I hadn't realized was like an old Bob Dylan fan.
Mm-hmm.
And like I found out, oh, that's not his real name. Like he left home when he was 18, you know, a month or two later, like he shows up in New York City. And by then he had started using the name Bob Dylan and now he's legally changed it.
What is his real name?
I think it's Robert Zimmerman or something. Or Richard Zimmer, I forget exactly. It's embarrassing that I don't know that off the top of my head.
That's okay.
I remember saying to my dad, you know, I wonder what happened in that month or so that made him change.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, you know, I think that he was inside, he was Bob Dylan all along. I think there was a Bob Dylan inside of him. Yeah, that he just had to let out. That's kind of how I feel about it. I always felt like, David's on my website. It used to say like David Smith. It's a common name for an uncommon man.
Oh, that's actually not a bad tagline.
That was not a bad line, but it wasn't worth keeping the name to keep it.
Well, now since we're talking about your website, for people who have not seen you before, what types of things do you do?
My show is largely a comedy juggling show.
Mm-hmm.
80% of it. That's just not the 80% that the audience ever talks about afterwards.
That's right.
I usually kind of start my show with sword swallowing. Somewhere in the middle, I'll do some fire eating. And usually towards the end, I might do bed of nails on the crowd in the venue. And sometimes for some venues these days, you know, I might still break out glass walking. There's one or two other acts that I might break out.
Now, I read on your Facebook, you've been recently doing knife throwing.
I've been working on a knife throwing act off and on for years. It's a struggle. In terms of writing it, I feel like I have a brilliant setup and I don't have a punchline.
Mm.
Like it's, yeah. And every once in a while I get bold enough to put it in front of an audience and just be like, I'm going to keep doing this until I figure out what the ending of this act should be.
Okay.
And I'm still not there.
Now, I watched your video, your AGT video,
yeah.
And in that, you're not doing sword swallowing. You're not doing knife throwing. Tell us what you do.
Yeah, so my AGT footage is, at this point, sort of a weird blessing and a curse for my current career. I was on the first season. That was 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot has changed in my life since then. So I was on twice. In the first round, I did my comedy contortion act, which is still what I am sort of best known for, I would say, in the industry. And what most people don't know, I think, at this point, is that I've stopped doing it.
Oh.
In the past year and a half, I guess. Like, I'm just too old. Like, I can't do that act anymore.
well, tell us what it looks like.
Right. So I auditioned in New York for AGT, the first in their first auditions, their first open auditions. You know, this is the routine that in many ways launched my career. Because mm-hmm. really, for the first couple of years of my career, like, I had a little bit of juggling skill. I could eat fire. And I had this one really funny act where, in short, I would put my legs behind my head and play guitar and play Bend Me, Shape Me, Any Way You Want Me.
Okay.
And like, that's the payoff. And so really, for me, what was fun about it was sort of almost delaying the payoff as long as I could. This was like a 5-minute, sometimes a 6-minute act.
Before you got the guitar, right?
Or before the guitar even came out. For a long time, this was my closer. Like, there was this long monologue about, like, you know, ladies and gentlemen, in just a moment here, I'm going to put both legs behind my head and then stand on my hands. And many of you may be wondering why.
Yeah.
And I think that the answer lies in my childhood. And I'd go on this long, you know, yeah. And talk about how, you know, I you know, I'm somebody who needs your love.
Yeah. Well, that's the smart way of going about it. Most of the great entertainers, you know, I'm a magician myself. Mm-hmm. And if you break down any magic trick, the trick itself only lasts
seconds.
Yeah. Seconds, exactly. It's the lead up and the build up and the hilarity that ensues.
Penn Jillette talks about how, like, you know, juggling the broken bottles takes 10 seconds, but he builds it for 10 minutes.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah. So that was sort of the cornerstone of my act for many, many years. And when I went on AGT, you know, I did a very shortened version of the monologue. The producers came out and they were like, yeah, that's great. But how about we just skip the monologue? We're just going to have you come out on stage. Legs are already behind your head and you just play the guitar. I said, no.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to do it that way. Well, we think it would be better. And I was like, okay, but no. Yeah, no, we're not doing it that way.
Yeah.
The top producer, I forget what the dude's name was, but, like, you know, some British guy walks out and he's like, yeah, but it might not make air if you don't do it the way we think it would be best for television. And I was like, I don't care if it makes air. It's absolutely immaterial to me if it makes air. We're doing this my way or we're not doing it. And he was like, okay, fine, you make the call. So I did it. They voted me through the next round. And, you know, like, I get together with my friends, like, you know, they're like, yeah, it's going to air on this date. And when it makes air, they only actually air the part they wanted, just the last, you know, seconds of it.
So no matter what you did, they're going to
cut. You know, they cut the entire monologue, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have gotten through to the next round without the monologue. It wouldn't have played well without the monologue. So I'm glad, in some ways, you know, for my own pride, that I stuck to my guns on that one.
Sure.
Even if the, you know, result didn't come out exactly the way I wanted it to.
Yeah, but then there's something to doing a routine, working your way into a routine also.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Jumping into the routine or jumping into the magic trick or in your case, the guitar playing.
It's
not as effective.
No, of course not. To be honest, when people book me for, oh, we need you to do a short show, you know, like 20 minutes, it's weird for me. Like, I'm so used to doing like 45 minutes to an hour. Like, yeah. I feel like, dude, they're not even warmed up for the first 20 minutes.
I get a lot of those where my show runs around 45 minutes and mm-hmm. I get a lot of those 25, 30 minutes. I want you to do 25 or 30 minutes. I'm like, okay, I'll start 15 minutes in.
Yeah.
Because that way I have the last part of my show and I go straight through.
I understand you do a lot of schools, and there's probably like some, for very younger audiences, that makes sense in their heads. Like, ah, oh, you're not going to hold their attention for a full 45.
Actually, you know, I get that comment a lot, and then I do the full 45 minutes for the younger ones. Most of the time when they ask me to cut the show, it's for a festival or a mall, or something like that.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, with if like when I'm doing like a county fair, yeah, they're on like a half hour
right
schedule, and you need like 5 minutes to get your stuff off. You need 5 minutes to get the next guy's stuff on stage. Right. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So you make it through the first round of AGT with the legs behind the head thing. And then the second round.
Yeah. So I had a friend at the time, a dancer who I had taught to do some fire eating and whip cracking and whatnot. We did a routine to, there's an old Tom Lehrer song. If you're not familiar with Tom Lehrer, audience, pause this right now. Go to YouTube and watch everything Tom Lehrer has ever done.
And how do you spell that, Lehrer?
L-E-H-R. It's a weird spelling. That's a good question.
Yeah, I remember it being a weird spelling. It's like L-E-H-R-E-R or something.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
So you do a dance to...
So his song, The Masochism Tango, I thought was hilarious in that so much of Sideshow is sort of has this sort of inherent masochism to it.
Yeah, Bed of Nails. And
the Bed of Nails, yeah, and fire eating and all of these things. And
sword swallowing.
So, you know, he had a line about, you know, set fire to my tie as we dance to the masochism tango, you know, and she sets fire to my tie and, yeah. And then we both eat fire and we toss the torches away. And
what made you decide to cross the Sideshow with the singing?
You know, I have just a very casual background in singing. Like I sang a little bit my high school musical and a little bit in like choirs and whatnot, and like was never a soloist. I can't read music, but I got to the point where I felt like, well, I can carry a tune. Okay. You know, I have a lot of respect for professional singers. I know enough to realize like, oh, wow. I you know, like the difference between me and a singer is really huge. I enjoy singing though. And there have been other times in my career where I've found ways to kind of bring a little bit of I guess, musical theater in a way to my variety performances.
So it gives your performance more variety.
In a sense. Yeah. It's an unusual mixture and I enjoy it. For a while I was working on what I thought of as the reversed role, Let It Go. I was singing Let It Go from Disney's Frozen.
Yeah.
With slightly rewritten lyrics to be about fire and eating fire while I was doing it.
Okay.
Which I really loved and played well to a lot of the family demographics that I was performing for at the time.
Yeah.
The finale of it was like I was trying to like hold the last note while holding the torch in my teeth.
Okay.
Which is a cool moment. But really challenging in terms of not burning your lips.
I'm sure.
There's a certain amount of exhaling you have to do to keep the torch lit but not burning you. And that amount of exhalation I've discovered is often subtly different from the amount of exhalation necessary to sustain the note I was trying to sing.
Ah.
And it was surprisingly difficult to prioritize the not burning my lips.
So have you dropped that act or are you working on it?
I occasionally still give it a shot. It is also something that I can only do indoors. Fire eating is way harder outside.
Uh-huh.
And so there are only certain venues where I can eat fire indoors, yada, yada, yada.
That's right. Cause I get contracts that say no fire and big.
Very common for me. Fire eating for me is typically like a 2 to 3 minute routine within the context of my, you know, 45 minute to hour long show.
Mm.
I tell my clients, hey, if I can eat fire, that's great. I'm insured for it.
Sure.
If I can't, no worries. The show just got...
It's still entertaining.
The show is just as entertaining. The bank of material I can pull from is 2 minutes shorter.
Right. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and go back into the little Wayback Machine. We're going to go back to when you were 9 years old. I read you were a bit of a door-to-door salesman.
Yeah. So I remember telling this story to someone... years ago and then being like, oh, you got to put that in your show.
Oh yeah.
I didn't always want to do this. When I was 9, I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, but not when I grew up, just right then.
Mm-hmm.
But there aren't a whole lot of venues that you can play when you're 9 years old. So I went around my neighborhood selling jokes door to door. I would knock on people's doors and tell them I was selling jokes for 10 cents a joke. One guy actually fell down laughing. when I told him that. So I charged him.
Okay.
He paid. And ever since then, I've been making people laugh until they gave me money.
I shall torture you with laughter until you give me money.
Yes. And so, you know, if I'm doing this again in this sort of, you know, hat-passing setting, I'll then say, you know, and, you know, while you've been watching me, I've been watching you. And some of you have been laughing a lot. This lady owes me $20.
There you go.
That's 21.
I'm going to owe you money after this.
Right. So, but whatever you can give would be appreciated. Thank you. Okay.
You know, yeah, just pass the hat through the microphone and we'll be fine.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So when did you first think to yourself, I think I'll swallow swords and beds of nails and walk on glass. Hey, that's a great living. At what point in time does someone say that?
So for me, when I was 15, my dad taught me to juggle. And my dad is a terrible juggler. I want to put that out there.
If he's listening to this, you'll get a phone call.
Oh, he's well aware. Okay. But a surprisingly good teacher of a skill he can barely do. My brother, I have two younger brothers and one who's just a bit younger than me. And so my brother, Mike, I'm 15, Mike's 14, I think. Mike walks into my bedroom juggling three baseballs one day. I was like, where did you learn to juggle? And he was like, Dad taught me. And I was like, what do you mean Dad taught you? Because I had this sort of image, I guess, that like if you knew how to juggle, you just walk around juggling all the time.
That's what you do.
Right, yeah. So I went and talked to Dad and discovered, oh, Dad's terrible at this, but you know, he taught me how to do it. My brother, Mike, had been, at that point, an all-star athlete his whole life. He was a state-ranked wrestler. He was, you know, an all-star baseball player. So Mike, probably start to finish, could juggle three balls competently in like 10 minutes. Hmm. And it was probably 2 weeks before I caught up with him. Like, I was not an athlete. Like, I never even played soccer, you know, like kiddie soccer or anything. So here I am at 15, and I was like, just really taken with this. Juggling was the first, I think, physical activity that I put real effort into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in large part because it is specifically not a sport. I'm a really tall guy. So people will often say to me like, oh, do you play basketball? And like my default answer is like, no, I'm not a team player. It's all about me.
Okay. How tall are you?
I'm 6'7".
Oh.
So yeah, I'm a big dude.
And you wear that top hat.
I do, because, you know, I can't hide it. I might as well flaunt it.
You're like 7 feet tall when someone...
I am a large presence when I walk into the room, yeah. which has its pros and cons in that if I am in a room that already has a low ceiling, it becomes tough to juggle.
Mm.
But there are rooms where I don't need a stage as much as another performer would.
Yeah.
So there are pros and cons there.
So you're 15 years old and you're learning to juggle and...
I'm learning to juggle. About 2 weeks later, like I feel like I catch up with Mike, you know, like I get to where he got to in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And Mike is done at that point. And I keep going to the best of my ability for a while. Like I go to my library, I take out the two books they have on juggling, try to figure out what I can from those.
So where did you go from juggling to the sideshow act?
When I went to college, I went to school at Penn State. They had a juggling club, a pretty good juggling club. Mm-hmm. And I remember I walked in the first day. I was sort of aware of how to juggle four, but it wasn't doing it very well. But like I walked in the first day and there's a dude running like six balls really well.
Oh, man.
So there's a lot of skill, you know, pretty high skill level among the dozen or so guys who were showing up there regularly. And that was the first time that I really hung out with other jugglers and found out that I wasn't as good as I thought I was.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a year or two later, I met the guys who had created the Performing Magicians Club, which they specifically called the Penn State Performing Magicians to distinguish from Magic the Gathering.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Popular at the time. So the Magicians Club was different. You know, the Juggling Club were guys who were very technically good jugglers who had zero interest in performing as jugglers.
Mm.
And this is something that one of the many differences sort of culturally between like the magic world and the juggling world is that magic doesn't happen without an audience.
You know, what's funny about that is that I know a number of people that are in magic rings, which are little magic clubs that sit in their basement, and they are amazing at cards and coins and different things, but don't perform in front of an audience. So I don't know if that is necessarily a difference. You just never see those guys.
I guess with magic, my impression was always that there was a certain amount of people who liked to like join the clubs or read the books because they wanted to know the secrets, either figuring out the puzzle or just, you know, paying the money and being like, I need to know. I want to know how that's done.
And nowadays with YouTube, it's so easy for someone now to type in if they know the right thing to type in. Take a look and find out how it's done. And it satisfies that itch.
So yeah, you're right. There is that there. But yeah, you know, so in the juggling world, there's, you know, a huge number of people who are way more skilled than I will ever dream of being, who have zero interest in ever performing.
Yeah.
But in contrast, the Magic Club at Penn State was all guys who wanted to be professional magicians.
Mm.
I think all of them are at this point.
So what makes you decide, I'm going to start sword swallowing?
Let me think. I guess two of the guys in the club, in the Magic Club, knew how to eat fire. Mm-hmm. And so they taught me that, like in a parking garage, like at Penn State one night. And what the after I, you know, sort of learned some basics from the one of them, like he's like, the one of the other guys is like, you know, like, hey Scott, you know, why don't you do a blast? Takes a swig of lamp oil and, you know, does this, spits this big fireball, and then like some smoke detector in the parking lot goes off and we all grab everything. And like the one older guy in the group is like, guys, don't run. It makes you look guilty.
Yeah.
Anyway, funny memory of that.
No, that was good.
So I started eating fire, and then there were a couple of really great sideshow acts who had come to Penn State at the time, had really great on-campus programming. So we'd see, you know, a lot of variety acts every week. Mm-hmm. They brought in great magicians and hypnotists and jugglers, and two of their regular acts, you know, they'd bring back every year were Todd Robbins, who was a huge influence on me, and Harley Newman.
Oh, okay.
That was going to be really embarrassing if I didn't pull that name out.
Another phone call that you get.
Yeah, right. Well, that one would have been way more embarrassing to me. So yeah, seeing those guys essentially every year for 4 years was really big. And, you know, Harley, especially in the way he, I don't know if he does this anymore, but back then, the bed of nails was a big part of his show. And after his show, he would be like, yeah, if anybody wants to come up and lie down on the bed of nails, go right ahead.
Oh,
that was a great experience for me. And like after, I guess, one or two tries of that, I was like, I can just build one of these. I already know I can do it. What's stopping me is just, you know, an afternoon of hammering.
Yeah. So now you have juggling under your belt. You have
basic juggling, you know, so I'm like 20, you know, 19, 20 years old. I've dabbled in magic a little bit enough to realize I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Magic to me is so much higher risk than juggling is. Like, I always say that if you drop a ball while you're juggling, in some ways it makes the show better. The audience realizes you're not perfect. In some ways, like, overcoming that obstacle can make it a more interesting show.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you, I feel like, in that moment, like, let the audience know really clearly, like, I'm not defeated by this.
Right.
I'm not concerned.
Yeah, I was just talking to Nick Lewin about this, who's a magician. And we were talking about how when you do make a mistake, or it appears that you make a mistake, it'll actually draw the audience in more and make you...
It can.
Yeah, it can draw the audience in more. Right. So when you're successful at the very end, it's an even bigger moment.
Yeah. Dave Gillies, great juggler here in Philly, who is one of my big mentors. He likes to tell young jugglers, when you drop the prop, whatever it is, the tendency is to, like, out of shame, look at the prop, like look away from the audience, look down.
Yeah.
And even at, or just, you know, look down at the thing you just dropped, like practically, I want to grab this quickly and then, you know, pick it up and go back to what I'm doing. He's like, but before you start doing what you're doing, and in his mind, like right away, as soon as the prop hits the ground, look at the audience, like make eye contact with them.
Uh-huh.
He's like, the most basic thing you can do is when the prop hits the ground, turn to the audience, make eye contact with them, smile, connect, and say, whoops.
Yep.
Let them know, I am not defeated by this. And then go pick it up and do what it was that you were about to do, especially in a street performing setting where the audience can walk away.
Yeah.
That is the moment where you have to let them know, no, I'm still good. I've got this.
In the magic world, we have what's called an out. If something doesn't go right, you always have an out.
Yeah, there's certainly versions of that in my show.
I know a lot of jugglers and magicians that make that happen.
Yeah, there's a bit of that in my show, which is tough because if you have intentional drops, there's only so many real drops you can afford then.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
So you have to be pretty confident in the rest of your material to put in intentional drops.
You know, one of my favorite things I saw on, I was watching your videos, and you do one routine. I call it, I don't know what you call it, but I call it kid juggling.
Yeah.
What is that? Tell us about that.
Oh, that's an old street performing bit. Yeah, jugglers been doing that forever.
I've never seen it before. So what does that look like?
Typically, the way I do it is, I get a little boy out of the audience, tell him to, hold his hands up. And there's again, a whole bunch of shtick that goes into setting this up. But basically, I tell the kid, I'm going to pick you up and juggle you. And the kid has to be like, cool with this, get the right, like a boy of the right age is like, all right, let's do this,
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things, as a performer, I'm sure you realize this, like, it's so funny to me that I can't pick a girl out of the audience for this.
For any routine, a boy is better or a girl is better.
Right, yeah. And so for this routine, like, if I were to pick up a little girl out of the audience would gasp.
Yeah.
And be like, oh my God, what is he doing to that poor little girl? But if you pick up a little boy, they're like, oh, that's hilarious. Crowd psychology. Trial and error crowd psychology is so much a part of what we do.
Yep.
But anyway, so this is one of those things where it's absolutely adamant, have to pick a boy. No boy in the audience, this trick doesn't happen.
Yep.
I pick up a kid on one arm, like sort of my forearm around him, his belly. Mm. And, so I've got him on one arm and I've got two beanbags in the other hand. And I'm juggling the two beanbags in one hand. And then I toss the two beanbags high in the air out of my right hand. And then, the kid I'm holding on my left arm, I switch over to my right forearm.
Yes.
And the two beanbags land in my left hand. Once I get a rhythm going, this becomes toss too high with the left, switch the kid, toss too high with the right, switch the kid, just high toss, shift, high toss, shift.
And you're juggling a small child.
I'm juggling a small child. Yeah. Really, really old school street performing juggling act that I learned from other old school street performers.
That's great.
It's one of those ones that I'm slowly retiring. Just because I'm getting too old for it.
Oh yeah.
That's it. That is a young man's game.
Now I sent you an agreement. And one of the questions that I ask in the agreement is, what are you passionate about talking about?
Yeah.
And a lot of people, they say things like, juggling, magic, mm-hmm. the business. And you said something much more interesting. ADHD.
Yeah. This has become kind of a focus of my life over the past couple of years. I always realized, like, I clearly have ADHD. In the past couple of years, I was like, okay, I need to seek help for this because my coping mechanisms that I've been getting by with, once I had kids, I was like, I'm not getting by anymore. having kids like stress tests your life.
Oh yeah. How many kids do you have?
I have two kids now. I have a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Okay.
Little girls. So yeah, that exposes wherever the weakness lies in your life, wherever.
Yeah, it certainly does. It makes it much bigger. Yeah.
Yeah. So suddenly I felt like, okay, I need, what I am doing now is not sufficient and I need to find professional help to help me address this. I need to read up on this subject. I need mm-hmm. to find, people who are experts on this. And that is such a deep topic.
Yeah.
That even years later, like I feel like, oh, I only have a very cursory understanding of this, but still way more of an understanding than I did 4 years ago when I kind of started on that path. And so there's part of me that kind of low-key thinks, what is it that I could say to kids about this like journey that I've been on that would be helpful to them? What is it that I could say to educators that would be helpful to them? Because it's shocking to me how many professionals in psychology don't have a real firm grasp of what ADHD is, how it's, effective ways of dealing with it. I had a hard time finding somebody who really knew their stuff there.
Oh.
And it's a huge issue. There's a ton of people who are affected. And furthermore, there are certain coping mechanisms from it that, apply to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
People who are wired like me need more help with organization, need more help with managing their either absent-mindedness or impulsivity or both.
Mm-hmm.
Those are things that everyone deals with.
A couple thoughts come to mind. First of all, I know a number of entertainers that have ADHD.
It's incredibly common in our world.
It really is. And I wonder, is it a double-edged sword? How has it been an advantage and how has it been a disadvantage to you?
Yes, it is a double-edged sword. Part of the reading on it, part of the research is people talking about like, look, let's acknowledge that there are good things about this. I think that people might not realize is that many people who have ADHD have a state that we that is commonly referred to as hyperfocus, something that is exciting or interesting, challenging to them in good ways is something that they will dive into and not come up for hours.
Ah.
I remember when I was a kid, educators asking my mom, like, oh, does he have trouble reading a book? Does he have the patience to sit down and read a book? And she was like, that's all he does.
Oh,
he'll sit down for hours and read a book. And now I realize the more relevant question would have been, can you give him a boring book and force him to read it?
See what happens.
Yeah. Like, could you give him a really boring book and be like, hey, will you read this for $100?
Ah.
Is there anything you could give him to make him read a boring book?
Mm-hmm.
Because no, there wasn't. There never was.
Wow. So have you used that? I imagine you have used that hyper-focus for your act.
But that's the thing, is that you can't choose what inspires hyper-focus.
Mm.
And so, you know, I joke about this sometimes in my show, like I didn't choose the jug life. The jug life chose me. Okay. But it's true. And that's true for everyone who's wired like this. The thinking right now is that there's, you know, sort of a bit of a shortage of dopamine in brains like mine.
Okay. Is that what causes ADHD or?
That's in broad strokes. Yes. That's the thinking.
Okay.
Right now. And so most of the drugs that are used for ADHD affect dopamine levels.
Mm-hmm.
When the ADHD mind, you know, finds something that's interesting, that's fascinating, the dopamine level spikes.
Okay.
And suddenly it's at levels that make them feel good, that make them feel comfortable, that make them happier.
Okay.
When their baseline dopamine level is raised by medication, then they can start making decisions about how to spend their time, not based on like, ooh, this just made my dopamine spike. I'm going to do this for the next 3 hours.
Mm.
Then they can actually make decisions based on like, what's the best and most useful use of my time and effort for the next 3 hours?
Right.
But if you are short on dopamine and miserable without it, because then whatever spikes your dopamine is what you're going to spend time on. The shiny thing that just passed by out the window, ooh, spike of dopamine. Like whatever you were doing is suddenly not important. You just had a spike. And you're going to let go of it. And so all of your priorities are based on, ooh, I just got a little hit of dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it means, you know, squirrel. Like,
yeah.
It means being easily distracted from anything that is in any way boring or even just mildly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
By something that is more interesting, but it also means when something is really fascinating to you, a good book or a challenge like juggling, where you can sort of set your own levels, like what am I going to work on today? What's a fun juggling challenge for me today? Mm-hmm. I'm going to work on 4 balls, you know, in this pattern today.
Yeah.
Because that's a level of challenge that is fun for me.
Mm.
And you get to set your own level there to find a challenge that is just right for your level, current level of ability and interest.
That makes complete sense why it's a double-edged sword, because yeah, yes. You do have that hyper-focus, but also right. Your hyper-focus can be over there or over there.
Exactly. And suddenly there are bills that have gone unpaid. Suddenly there are, you know, stuff that's piling up. Suddenly there's emails that you have to send to clients who are trying to get in touch with you. It's largely for my personal life. That I was inspired, like, again, like having kids made me feel like, oh God, I am just drowning under all of the responsibilities that I'm not keeping up with. Sort of tackling this problem has begun to have payoffs in my professional life as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it has been just accepting that as difficult as it is to afford, I've got to outsource some of this office work to someone, you know, who's more detail oriented than I am.
Mm.
Who can make sure that my calendar is well managed.
Yeah.
Not just that everything is in there, but that I have figured out what the drive times are going to be like, and when I'm leaving, when I'm getting back, how much time I have to take for, you know, from this show to this show. Someone with absolute attention to detail has to be dotting all those I's, crossing all those T's.
Sure. Do you have somebody like that now?
I do. And it has been life changing.
Has it been?
Oh my God.
And probably career changing too.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? It's funny. It's made me more, I'm doing more marketing now. In a sense, I did very little marketing throughout most of my career. It was largely word of mouth. A lot of it, I think, it comes from, like, I'm so much more confident now as a businessman.
Yeah.
You know, with the business end of my show business.
Yeah.
I was always very confident in my show and very insecure about my business, about my ability to handle it. So the past 4 years of both having some better handle on the details myself and outsourcing a lot of the details to someone who is naturally more comfortable with it than me has made me a lot more comfortable and has freed up a lot of mental space for me to focus on the show and on the parts that I do well and that I excel at.
Do you find that your ADHD affects you during your show?
No. Being on stage is the most dopamine rewarding activity you could possibly engage in.
By the way, for ADHD people and not ADHD people, for me too.
No, yeah, totally. Of course. There are a lot of things that can contribute to dopamine. Something that's new, something that's exciting, something that's a little bit dangerous. There are a lot of things that can spike that chemical. And almost all of them happen in my show.
Yeah, they do.
That's not accidental. That's me, you know, following my bliss and following.
This is all suddenly making sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the dangers of being someone with ADHD is so often there are risk-taking behaviors you can find in life that are not sustainable. Like my sword swallowing is, I feel like, me finding a risk-taking behavior that is actually the healthiest use of my time.
Yeah.
That I could have come up with.
Sword swallowing and the whole thing. Bed of nails.
You know, I know very old sword swallowers. Like,
yeah.
There are guys who've been keeping that going for decades.
It's not something that ages you.
Not if you do it right.
We're going to move on to a fact or something John just made up. Sound like something fun?
Sure, let's do it.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to read a headline, and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little bit more about it.
Sure.
All right, here we go. First headline. An MC once surprised David by putting a scorpion on him.
That is true.
What happened there?
I don't know if you've ever been to a juggling convention.
No.
But one of the things that happens certainly at a lot of the larger juggling conventions is what they call the Renegade Show. Typically, the Renegade Show is something that happens like at midnight at a bar near where the convention is happening. And it's a sort of an open stage. And usually there's, you know, somebody hosting, a couple of people, jugglers come in, they sign up for this open mic night, essentially. And because it's a late show, because people are drinking, usually do some of the weird, you know, sort of off-color stuff they've got in their repertoire. So I'm there doing my comedy contortion act. Mm-hmm. Mark Fay is hosting the Renegade Show that night. Mark toured with, like, the Jim Rose Sideshow.
Okay.
Mark's, like, super high-skilled juggler, but also, like, a guy who will balance a lawnmower on his face and people will toss heads of lettuce into it while it's running. Wild act, wild guy. So I'm there with both legs behind my head. I'm not playing guitar yet. I'm still doing my monologue. Mark Fay walks out on stage, places a live scorpion on my groin.
Oh.
Keeps walking, walks off stage.
And you have your legs behind your head.
Yeah. I'm in a compromised position. And the audience just cracks up, thinks this is hilarious. And I'm just, as of the performer, looking down at this scorpion thinking, okay, what is the funniest thing I can say right now?
Yeah.
And absolutely nothing comes to me, which is actually in a way fine because the audience, like I said, is just rolling in the aisles. And my friends in the back of the room are at a table, like talking with each other the rest of the night. So what is it that Dave should have said in that moment?
Yeah.
And my favorite one they came up with is you should have just looked down and sighed and said, not again.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's go on to the next one.
Yeah.
David once ate a light bulb.
I would say rather that I tasted it. I nibbled it.
Did you?
I did. Yeah, I've done it. I've never eaten an entire light bulb, but like some of my mentors have. I've chewed up like a small piece of it, you know, swallowed, lived to tell the tale.
Were there any repercussions from that?
Not if you do it perfectly.
Oh, man.
There are many things in the sideshow world. You know, there's a couple of sideshow acts that I do and that I really enjoy. And I enjoy all kinds of sideshow acts, watching them. But there are a lot of them that I don't feel like fit my character, don't fit my show. I have kind of a weird niche. I do a lot of I do a lot of family entertainment.
Mm.
And I really try to make the sword swallowing, the fire eating, the bed of nails funny and accessible for like the entire family. I just think it's fascinating that a human being can do this.
It is.
And so I don't try to present those things in a way that freaks people out. I try to downplay it, if anything, you know? I try to play it for comedy, but I try to be really like reassuring to the audience. This is going to be fine, folks. Relax.
Yeah, relax. I'm not eating an entire light bulb.
Right. And there's certain acts in the sideshow world that I feel like I don't think I can get away with that. And so even like glass walking, I don't usually do if there's kids in the audience because every once in a while I bleed a little bit.
Yeah.
Never anything that a Band-Aid can't handle, but I feel like that's a line I don't want to cross if there's kids in the crowd.
Sure. And you don't want kids going home trying that stuff.
Yeah, that's an easy one to try too. Like there's a certain part every couple of years, it's actually surprisingly rare, a parent will come up to me and say, do you ever worry that a kid's going to go home and try this? And I'm always like, do you have a bed of nails in your garage?
Yeah.
Because if you do, it's kind of on you.
Yeah, there you go. All right, next one. Dave's wedding was featured in the New York Times.
That is true.
Oh!
So the New York Times has a section called Vows, where I think it's in the Sunday paper, where they do an article on a wedding. You know, it's funny, like a month or two after, you know, there's a comedic online newspaper, The Onion.
Yeah.
About a month or two after we got married and after our vows, because it's very tough to get into vows. Like you fill out an application and like I said, they do one of these a week. So it's something that people, you know, sort of take pride in that somebody, you know, that the New York Times covered their wedding.
Yeah.
And so like a month or two after our article came out, The Onion did an article that was like, the headline was lavish, quirky Jewish wedding, still not lavish, quirky, or Jewish enough to make the New York Times vows section.
Okay.
And we looked at each other immediately and cracked up. And we were like, we got this one on quirk.
You do.
Yeah.
I read the article and I wanted to point out a couple of things in it.
Sure.
First, who married you?
You know, this is one of the things that I don't think the reporter kind of really was as impressed by this as she should have been.
I was.
Right. Thank you. So the amazing Randy was our officiant.
Mm-hmm.
And like Penn and Teller are big influences sort of on my career, on in some ways on me as a person. I got to meet them pretty early on. Really before my career began, while I was still in college, I got to meet them and they were so super generous with their time. They came and did a show at Penn State. And me and my magician friends came up to them and were like, are you guys doing anything now? And they were like, yeah, we'll hang out. And then just like, yeah, just spent like 3-4 hours chatting with us. You know, we were all like 20. It was amazing.
Wow.
One of my friends in that group got to be really close with Teller.
Oh.
Teller is from Philadelphia. And me and him, you know, we moved to Philadelphia after Penn State. And Teller would come back and visit his parents every once in a while. And we became one of the handful of folks that Teller knew in Philadelphia, if his parents needed a little help around the house.
Mm.
Guys, could you go to my parents' house and like lift an air conditioner and put it in the window.
Teller's calling you up and saying, can you come visit my parents' house? They need a little bit of help.
You go over, they were living at like 20th and Cherry, which was, you know, a couple minutes from us. Yeah, me and my buddy, Francis Minotti, would go over there and help them out. I wasn't like super close with him. I had a phone number for Teller, and an email address for him. And my wife, while, you know, not a magician, her dad had dabbled in magic a little bit and was a huge James Randi fan in terms of his work as a skeptic.
Okay.
So she grew up with her dad reading her Flim Flam and other James Randi books.
By the way, for anybody listening to this who doesn't know who James Randi is.
It's
a whole nother podcast, but I'll be quick.
Oh, totally.
He's the guy that, did he offer, I think, $1 million or something like that?
Yep. $1 million if anyone could prove to him under his conditions that they had psychic powers. And every once in a while, somebody steps up and attempts it. So far, he's no one has passed. So
there's many YouTube videos of him disproving psychic powers.
Yeah. So
look at those after this. We'll move on because we can go hours. Right.
Yeah, of course. That's a deep rabbit hole to jump down. But so anyways, it's from that work that my wife knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking about planning our wedding, like there was a moment where suddenly she was like, do you think James Randi would officiate our wedding?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's a long shot, but I know who to ask. And yeah. I sent Teller an email and said, hey, do you think James Randi would be interested in officiating my wedding? And he was like, hang on, let me call him. 5 minutes later, he emails me back. He's like, yeah, Randy's in.
That was it.
Yeah. He's like, here's his email. You reach out to him. And I wrote to James Randi. He said, oh, thank you so much. Teller tells me that you'd be willing to do this. And Randi wrote back to me and he's like, yeah, I do whatever Teller tells me to do. He scares me.
And so, okay. So James Randi marries you and then you get married and now you're walking back down the aisle.
So my wife is Jewish. And so there is the tradition of stepping on a glass,
right,
and breaking it. And so, you know, I stepped on the glass, I broke it, and then I gathered up all the broken glass, poured it into a pile of larger broken glass, kicked off my shoes and socks, picked up my wife and carried her across the pile of broken glass. Yeah.
Oh, perfect. The perfect way to end the perfect wedding.
Right.
All right, we're going to move on to the next one because we can go on for hours on this. All right, next headline. David has posed for the covers of over 50 romance novels.
That is something that people ask me about occasionally or joke about, but sadly I have never been asked to pose for the cover of a romance novel.
Oh, that would be another good income for you.
I'm not opposed to it. If anybody's interested, I'm down for it. I should probably hit the gym a little harder if I'm gonna. I do have long hair. That is kind of a signature look for me. Has been since high school.
Yeah, tall, good looking, long hair. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Well. Wait, did this just get weird? This guy.
Oh, it's been way worse than this. This is only marginally weird.
All right, well, we're going to go on to the next one. This is the last one.
Okay. Dave
once asked a volunteer to put her left arm around his neck, but was in for a big surprise.
Yeah, she didn't have a left arm.
Oh.
Yeah, and this is a super long story, but I will condense down. Again, my buddy Francis and I were living together in Philly at the time and we're doing like a show at a small theater. Because it's surprising how much you just assume that people have two arms.
Yeah.
In my defense, her arm cut off about midway down her left forearm. She comes up on stage and I say, Miss, I'm going to pick you up and carry you across this pile of broken glass. And she's like, yeah, sure, fine. I'm like, okay, great. Now I'm going to pick you up. If you could, just put your left arm around my neck. And she just goes, real casual. She goes, I don't have a left arm.
Oh.
I look down. Sure enough, there is no hand at the end of that sleeve.
Oh, God.
I was like, that's okay. You can use your right arm. And this was a show that we did maybe, I don't know, it was a long weekend. I think we did like 4 or 5 shows, runs of this little 2-person show we did in this theater. It's a small theater. It's like 40 seats. this is one of those shows where you look out into the audience and before the show starts and you're like, there's six people in the crowd.
Mm.
She's one of them, right? And we use seven volunteers in this show.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's going to get picked twice. Sadly, it was her.
Oh, no.
Because he's backstage prepping. He doesn't see this whole thing go down. So he comes out to do the next act, which, again, needs a volunteer. Sadly, he picks her.
No.
And says, hold out your hand, as he goes to put a card in her hand and says, no, the other hand.
Of
as
course. He always does.
She goes, super calm. She goes, I don't have another hand. That's fine. We can just use this hand. That'll be okay. Yeah, that's fine.
She has had to say that twice in one show.
Right after, back to back. The poor girl.
Oh, man.
That was Fact. Or Something John Just Made Up.
Thank you for letting me relive those traumatic memories.
You can be thinking about that all night now.
Right, yes.
All right, so we're going to move on to some fan questions.
Yeah.
Billy Damon, who you may know, he's an amazing entertainer out of Florida, says, hey, Dave, been a long time since we worked together. Can't wait to hear the podcast.
Not really a question, but thanks, Billy. Appreciate it.
That's it. All right, here's a real question. From Conrad Cologne, a terrific magician out of New Jersey, asks, how do you balance performing and family life?
It's hard. It's super hard. And my wife is amazing. Let me begin this conversation by saying that I have an incredible, wonderful, supportive wife.
Is she a performer also?
No, she is not. You know, she is someone who kind of thought like in her high school years about, maybe I should go into acting. Dove into it for a little bit and then decided, nah, this isn't the path for me.
Mm-hmm.
But made a lot of lifelong friends who are actors. I think her whole life, she's had a lot of friends who were performers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of why we work, is that she understands that.
Sure.
In a way that most people don't.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I want to say this, is that as a performer, there is a part of me that feels like she's never really going to understand parts of my life.
Mm.
For a long time when I was young, I thought the fact that like, oh, you know, I lead a very different life from a lot of other people. I'm going to have to find somebody from in my world to understand what I do. That was so wrong. That was a trap that I fell into for a long time.
Hmm.
Yeah. The time period where I met my wife was after I had decided, all right, no, I'm going to try to like actually meet regular people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort of separate a little bit myself from my career.
Yeah.
And that made that easier.
Yeah.
And it made me realize, you know what? There's parts of my life that she doesn't understand. There's parts of her life I don't understand. That's okay.
That's part of the deal.
That's, you know, you're not going to perfectly understand the person you're with.
Of course.
That was a revelation to me.
So she really helps. She really helps balance that.
She family really life. Bends over backwards to do everything she can to...
Oh, pardon the expression.
Yes. Yeah. Right. as a former contortionist. Yes. but there are limits, as understanding, as supportive as she is, to what she can handle, especially now with two kids. Especially now when opportunities come my way that involve any significant amount of travel, there's a discussion that has to happen about, okay, is this something that we can handle? Is there anything that I can do to make this easier, you know, on you in terms of the childcare while I'm away? Can we get a lot of babysitters scheduled? You know, we have family nearby who can help to a certain extent, but again, we lean on them a lot for this sort of thing. So how much can we afford to lean on them? So yeah, that's a constant struggle. There is a part of me that looks forward to when my kids get a bit older and when the part of me that loves what I do looks forward to the time when my kids don't want anything to do with me.
Once again, it's a double-edged sword, man.
It is.
Things come in cycles. When they're little, they just love you. You're dad.
Right.
You do no wrong. And then they get older. They don't need you. And
Yeah. And my two-year-old, like just last night, you know, I'm putting her to bed. Daddy, I don't like it when you go away.
Oh.
And it's so hard. I try to just keep, you know, a real even tone of voice and let her know that, yeah, sometimes daddy has to go away, but daddy always comes back and, you know, I'll give you big hugs when I get back.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes mommy has to go away for a little bit. And that's okay. You know, sometimes my wife has business trips, but it's hard. Yeah. And it cuts right to the bone. It does.
Yeah. That's why I started doing school assemblies.
And I get it. Yeah. No, I salute you. That was a strong decision as a family man performer, just to try to figure out how to stay home as much or close to home as much as you can.
Right. And on the weekends, you know, be able to spend the weekends with the kids, which is rough for entertainers.
It is. And that's a noble goal and a great goal. And it's a daunting one for me. You know, so much of the work that I really love to do and would love to do more of it would involve more travel.
Right, sure.
So much of the stuff that I think my current show would be perfect for, yeah, would involve more travel.
Yeah. Now that my kids are 20 and 26, I'm starting to tour more and be away more because I can.
Sure, right, yeah.
Because I choose to.
Right. You know, it's funny. People say, if you love what you do, you know, you'll never work a day in your life. And that's such a lie.
Yeah.
For many, many reasons. But one of the things that people don't realize about that when you love what you do is that when you love what you do and you love the people, you know, you're living with, you have these really gut-wrenching decisions to make that I think, man, if I hated this, it would be so much easier.
Yeah, it'd be easy to go out of town.
If I hated my job, it would be easy to be like, yeah, forget this, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to stay at home with the kids. I love my kids. They drive me crazy.
Like any kids.
Like any kids, yeah. With my first daughter, like I tried to stay home and be like the primary caretaker. And man, that was rough.
Yeah.
That was brutal. And the second time around, we got a nanny for the first couple months. And now we do that in the summer. Mm. When I'm just go, 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 and I'm away, you know, every day.
Yeah.
Doing, you know, summer camps or library tours or, you know, that kind of stuff.
I'm out every day during the summer.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And this will probably be the last year that we do that for our little one. And then probably be summer camp for the both of them.
Sure. And they'll love that. They'll love that.
Yeah. My older one loves her summer camp. And I can't wait until, the little one can join her at it next year. And they'll both be in the same school starting in September, you know, because it's a private school that goes from preschool at age 3 all the way through high school.
Woo! That'll be a big load off.
So it'll be one drop off. Yeah, drop the two of them in the morning in the same spot, and then you're out. You're done.
I've been there, man.
Exactly. So it's how do I balance family and
yeah, back to that question.
painfully.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
With a little bit of this and a little bit of that and daily struggles that add up to a life. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that answers that question as best as we possibly can.
Pretty much. Yeah. Good. Okay.
All right. Let's move on to a performer horror story. Do you have a horror story for us out of all the performances that you've done?
So the one I always love to tell here actually is not mine.
Okay. Well, give us one.
My friend Francis, you know, I told you about the one-armed woman who we both, you know, sadly picked for the one show we did together. So the prequel to that story is that and I'm ruining if Francis is ever a guest on your show, I'm totally stealing his thunder and taking his horror story because I love telling this horror story.
Okay.
So a couple of years before that, we're in college and Francis manages to land a corporate Christmas party, like biggest gig of his young career. And at the time, his finale is this thing where he like has one volunteer chain his hands behind his back while the other volunteer selects a card and then like throws the deck of cards at him. And he like breaks free from the chains in time to reach forward, grab, you know, as the cards are thrown at his chest, he reaches forward with one hand, grabs one card out of the air, their signed card, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. Great trick.
Great trick. Yeah. Right. So he says to the, you know, Miss, could you join me on stage? And sir, could you join me on stage? And he turns and looks at the woman as she comes up on stage on his right side. And the gentleman comes up on the left side of the stage, sort of while he's looking to the right. And so he turns around, he sees the guy next to him is facing the audience. And he sees that the gentleman on his left has a right arm. And foolishly, he assumes that means he has a left arm.
What's with you guys and the
we always thing? Get a visual now on both arms. We have learned this the hard way, all right?
Yeah.
Never assume anything. That's a rookie mistake, all right?
Yeah.
So he's handed the deck of cards to the woman on his right. He turns to the gentleman on his left, hands a set of chains and a padlock to the gentleman who takes it in his right arm. And he says to the guy, here, sir, would you take these chains and chain my hands behind my back? Turns his back to the gentleman.
Yep.
The audience, seeing the one-armed man holding the chains and looking at them incredulously, cracks up. Francis is like, I'm getting a weird reaction from the crowd tonight.
And he doesn't even see what's going on, right?
He has no idea what they're seeing, right? And the one-armed man says, are you serious? And Francis, as he always does, says, well, I guess you don't normally do this. The one-armed man, to his credit, tucks one end of the chain under his chin and starts wrapping the other end of the chain around Francis's hands. And it's taking a little longer than it usually does. Francis says the line that he always says here is like, well, you know, I'd lend you a hand, but...
No!
Weird reaction from the audience on that line, too. Francis is wondering what's going on tonight. The one-armed man, to his immense credit, eventually gets the padlock on the chains. Francis turns around and says, well, thank you very much, sir, and I... And all the color, like all the blood drains out of his face.
Oh, yeah.
Which is good, because in that moment, the audience realizes, like, oh, my God, he didn't know. They just thought he was a jerk up to that point, right? And, like, he turns to them after a moment of composing himself and says, all this time, I'm wondering what's so funny. And, again, they crack up, realizing that, oh, wow, he had no idea.
What a man.
Right? He finishes the trick. He manages to pull it out.
I got to tell you, you know, I interviewed the cruise ship guy, Craig. I'm going to get the phone call now.
Right.
Anyway, he talks about how he was doing a trick with a volunteer and the volunteer's ear fell off.
Oh,
so you can never be sure. So I guess the lesson to all this is, as soon as you invite a volunteer, make sure they have both their arms, both their ears.
Funny tangent to me that I thought was hilarious. Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, you know, was asked in an interview, like, why do you have, there's a teleprompter on stage with the lyrics to your songs. You've been singing the same lyrics for 35 years. Like, yeah. Why do you need the teleprompter? And he was like, dude, I was at a show a couple years back. There's a girl in the front row sitting on her boyfriend's shoulders, right? She reaches over, takes off her left arm, holds it up so I can see it. She's got written on it, I love you, Steven. Why do I have a teleprompter? Because when people take off their arms, you forget the words.
Yeah. Once again, arms. What's with you and
I don't know.
All right, I've taken enough of your time. I'm just going to ask for a recommended book, and we're going to say goodbye. So do you have a recommended book for us?
I'm going to punt here, and because I know most people give you like their favorite business or marketing book, which I applaud, because like it's only in the past few years I've focused on business and marketing stuff, and it's made a big change, and that's great. I don't care. I have a fiction book that I love that I always plug whenever I can, called The Name of the Wind. Lin-Manuel Miranda has signed on to be the director of it if it comes to make it into a movie. So hopefully in a few years, this will come to the big screen. But go get it now. Go check it out. It's the first book in a three, if you're into fantasy especially, but even if you're not, amazing book by Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind.
Cool. I'm going to put that on the show notes. Please. for your podcast. Also, I'm going to put the spelling of, is it Tom Lehrer?
I think it's pronounced Tom Lehrer. Yeah.
Okay, if I can find a couple of links, I might put a couple of links on your show notes page too.
Yeah, totally.
Do you have any social media you want to promote?
Yeah, my website is onemansideshow.com. You know, I'm on all major social media, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all those. I am, you know, at onemansideshow.
There you go. Well, thanks, David, for doing my show. You were awesome.
Thanks, John.
And thanks to all my variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, share it with your friends or on your social media. That's how we can create an entire variety arts revolution. Also, make sure to get your free audiobook from audible.com. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book to get your first book for free. You can reach me at my email at john@thevarietyartist.com or join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.